When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Hunting Beast Podcast, your source for hunting tactics, news, and stories. And now your host, Mario Traficante.
Hello, and welcome to episode 1 of the Hunting Beast Podcast. Today we will be discussing the impact of wind and thermals on whitetail hunting with the big buck serial killer himself, Dan Infault.
We're here with Dan Infault, big buck serial killer. Today we want to discuss wind and how wind can impact your deer hunt. So with that, Dan, why don't you take it away and give us your opinion on wind and how it affects your setups and potentially, you know, your hunts.
You know, I think a lot of people don't factor in wind correctly because they're not thinking about how the wind's going to change throughout the day and stuff like that. But you really got to look at wind like water, you know, and look at how it hits an obstacle. I mean, you yourself, you canoe and kayak a lot, right? I do too.
Yep.
You got to be able to predict what the water's going to do ahead of you, right? Mm-hmm. Wind ain't much different. I mean, when it hits a block of timber, like in farm country, you got blocks of timber on the edge of a field. You know, seldom does it hit it at a 90-degree angle. It hits it on, you know, some sort of cross angle. Well, that wind's going to flow down. You know, it's going to go down those trees. And some of it's going to go through, some of it's going to go down, and some of it's going to swirl when it hits that blockade. You know, and I think a lot of people don't grasp that. You know, look at an opening in the woods. You know, if you have a small opening, usually, you know, that's a transition and that's where deer are going to be. You know, so people want to hunt there because that's where the sign's going to be.
Right.
Well, everybody wants to go right in that opening. You go right in that opening and when the wind goes over the top of those trees, it's going to cause a vacuum effect. It's going to cause swirling. I'm sitting back from those openings. You know, I'm shooting into them from a distance. I'm looking at them from a distance and figuring out how's the wind going to react when it hits that hole, you know, from the direction it's going, from the angle of the trees and such.
So someone who's kind of new to this, when you talk about how you're sitting back from that opening, if I'm in an opening or right on the edge of that opening and the wind enters it, I mean, are you basically saying that that wind's going to, as it enters that opening, it typically can swirl around, then causing my scent, obviously, to pool in that opening? And how does that affect an incoming deer? Like, where are you positioning yourself in relationship to where you think the deer are then in that situation?
Well, I'm looking at how the deer comes into that opening. You know, I'm concentrating, okay, where's he coming from? I'm thinking about a plan here. And at what point would my wind hit him and for what reason? You know, and that wind doesn't just pool. I mean, your scent doesn't just pool. And it doesn't just swirl. I mean, if you think about wind going over that opening, and if it's going at a speed, it's going to cause a vacuum effect, and the wind on the backside is going to come back in the direction the wind above it came from.
Okay.
So, you know, throughout your whole sit there, things are going to change. Thermals are going to change and stuff. The opening, sun might be getting to the ground. That's going to cause thermal effect. It's going to cause rise. That's also going to cause more of this swirling effect as it's hitting the cold air that's blowing over the top of it. So not going right into that opening is the key. Not going upwind of it, obviously. So you got to come in at a side angle somehow, depending on which way the deer's coming from.
So let's focus a little bit on a potential setup. Like maybe you pick this spot out, or maybe you know of this opening on a field edge, and I've made this, I don't want to call it a mistake, but I've done this before in the past where I'll walk into a field of a typical place that I hunt, I'll see an opening like that, recognize it as a transition, and potentially I'll walk straight into the opening to the back side of it, and I'll set up. Now, my thought might be, well, if a buck is entering across that or coming straight into it, you know, how can that impact my hunt by walking through that opening? My access route to that opening also plays a factor in how wind can affect.
So now you're walking through that opening to the downwind side?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so now what I'm saying is when that wind comes across that opening, it's going to hit that wall on the other side as it sinks, and it's going to rotate around, and there's going to be a vacuum effect from it going over the top, and whenever it gets a little calm for a minute or two, your wind's going to kind of suck back the other direction. And that's where guys get that, where they're like, well, I've constantly got changing winds. You know, there's always wind shifts and stuff. That's why they think they need scent control and stuff, is because of those wind shifts. Well, I'm not getting those wind shifts because I'm staying in places where I'm predicting that it's not going to be. You know, so I'm trying to get off to the side of that opening, you know, on a crosswind kind of, you know, so I can shoot into that opening.
Right.
Or shoot the deer when he leaves the opening or when he's going into the opening.
Right. And this is an interesting example because you probably know one hut I'm going to bring up, but we had a place that you and I were hunting where it was on a swamp island. And that swamp island, a week prior, you identified a scrape and a rub that had opened up that previously weren't there. And that area where it opened up was an opening on that swamp island. And, you know, I had a chance to go in and set up in there. And actually how it kind of turned out, there was a wind coming across the island at an angle. Now, I set up on the upwind side. Well, the upwind on the back side of that opening. So the wind was actually blowing off my back at an angle across the island. Now, if the deer is walking straight in, my thought process is that the wind is going to be at an angle. He's got to get close enough to me before the wind becomes a factor. But actually what played out and what I observed was much different. And this kind of plays into what you were saying, because the wind blowing off my back shoulder, what appeared happened was it hit that opening and it swirled in that opening. Because I had that buck come in, and what was interesting about the hunt is that, and you picked this out, was that an immature buck came in earlier and he ran right through with no regard to the wind or direction or anything. But when that mature buck came in, the instant that he got into that opening, he raised his nose and he started scanning. And I don't know if you want to talk about it a little bit. We went back to that spot mm-hmm. in the spring to scout, and you asked me what tree I set up in, and you kind of did a little critique on what you felt the wind was doing and how you would have set up differently.
Yeah, I remember that hunt well. Okay, because the day before, I was coming out of that swamp and I had to cross that island. And when I came across that island, I noticed all those scrapes were really opened up, and a big rub line was opened up, and I knew that that was adjacent to a doe bedding area. And I knew the reason that was opened up is there's a big buck monitoring those does. And it was obvious that all of a sudden, all this sign, this thing's hanging here. And I know, when is he going to monitor does in a bedding area? During daylight, when the does are bedded there.
Right.
So you know he's cruising in there in daylight. Sometime during the day, he's checking on that. So my point was that had to be hunted immediately, and I was already committed to doing something the next several days. I had something I had to take care of, and you were hunting the same property. So I called you, and I said, go in there and take this certain access. And you knew the island well, so it wasn't hard for me to explain.
Right.
Follow that edge of the island so you're not walking down a deer trail. Well, you know enough to know that.
Right.
And then cut in and go up a tree. But to me, that cut in and go up a tree, I meant right on the edge.
Right.
And you had to hunt that day too, because that was your last day to hunt for a while.
Right.
And we knew we had to get in there. The wind was a little off. It was almost blowing to that doe bedding area.
Right.
It was just a little bit off of that. And that was critical in the setup. But to me, when I looked at that, and what looks obvious to me maybe doesn't look obvious to others because I've been doing this for so long. There was that opening where your scent's going to kind of shift down and pool, number one, like you noted.
Right.
And number two, that crosswind coming out, if you get to the edge a little bit, it wouldn't quite be blowing down and pooling there. Okay. But I also noticed that there was a pretty good crest to that island. Even though that island was only about, 15 yards wide?
Yeah, it wasn't really that. It's not.
But it had a pretty good crest.
It does.
And on both sides, it was wet on the outside.
Yep.
And especially to the, I believe it was the east, right?
Yep,
it was open.
The east side.
And open wet, so that water was heating all day. So you get the evening, and that's going to, when it starts to cool out, that water's going to hold heat longer. Mm-hmm. And so you had that water thermal, that heat's rising off that water, and that's going to pull air in from the island where it's cooler down there. So it's going to do that at the from the crest down and on the other side from the crest down. So you being on the other side of the island, your wind's actually pulling down the wrong way and then swirling back over to that opening.
Right.
And you, and even though, what was the difference between the trees? 10 feet?
Yeah, it was, yeah, I mean.
It wasn't much.
No.
It might have been more than 10 feet, but it was within 7 yards, I'd say.
Yeah, it was, I was on the west side of the crest. What you're describing is on the east side of the crest. Mm-hmm. The doe bedding is adjacent on the east side of the island that we're talking about. And that opening on the in the swamp island was pretty much sitting right in the middle of the crest. So.
And, you know, people talk about, Dan, you're so lucky. You know.
Right.
I never get an opportunity. I always get busted or this, that. And you just, they just walk right up to you. Maybe you smell good. But the difference is 10 yards.
Right.
I'm looking at that different. And a big part of that difference is that I've been using that milkweed for so long. And what's so great about that is it's a free product. You just go out and pick the stuff, right?
Right.
But you drop that stuff and you watch it. And a lot of times, now I'm setting up where most people would think you're upwind of the deer. Because I've learned how that air current flows by watching that milkweed. You got to not just look at wind direction, drop it and watch where it blows. You got to really pay attention to what that does. Think about what time of day it is. Drop that stuff constantly and watch what it does in the evening when the sun's starting to set. Watch what it does during the day when it's warm out. And you're going to be surprised what you learn. I've got spots where I set up directly with the wind blowing towards the buck. But you drop that milkweed, you watch it go out 10 yards and do a 90.
Right.
And turn with the edge of the woods when you got a certain wind. So certain places, I'm only hunting on certain winds. And I start to learn how to shift around and use different trees based on the exact wind, how it's going to change on the current. And a guy that's just setting up a stand and always going to that same stand doesn't have that. He's got whatever wind's blowing that day for that stand. You know, where I'm shifting my stand around based on the exact wind.
Well, and that brings up a good point, too, because we all check the weather and we look at, okay, what's the predominant wind for today? But you made an interesting comment that, you know, based on the layout and the topography of the place that I'm going, once you get inside a little bit of timber in a swamp, the predominant wind is going to be traveling at the greatest velocity up high in the trees. But what's actually happening at the forest floor is more going to follow that tree line, those little openings, those mm-hmm. little bends, those little curves.
And if you got rolling hills, it'll follow the hills too.
Right. So that can actually play to your advantage if you have to set up what potentially is downwind from where you perceive this buck bed to be. You know, so that case right there, you know, ironically enough, was literally, like you said, 10 to 15 yards difference. If I set up on the east side of that island, my wind is not blowing in, not getting sucked into that opening and swirling, and I potentially have a kill shot on that mature buck when it comes in. Instead, you know, the moment he hit that opening, he raised his nose, and he knew I was there. And you know, I didn't drop a milkweed into that opening that day. I probably should have after he busted me. Maybe I was just still frustrated from the fact that he busted me. But it would have been interesting to see where that would have floated in that scenario.
One of the real important things to me is that when you fail, you don't just shrug your shoulders and walk away. Why did you fail? You learn the most out of your hunts when you fail. Because if you succeed, you really don't think much of it. But when you fail, if you nitpick that down, why did I fail? And you fix those things. And you do that every time you fail, you're going to do nothing but get better.
Right. So I guess to summarize that little point about wind, I mean, understand your predominant wind, right? Understand your access point to where you're going. Because if you walk across that area like I described in the first example and get your scent between you and that access point of the deer, you're not setting yourself up for success because your scent is going to be taken back out to them. And I think know the topography of where you're at, right? Know how that potentially can control the wind. And I mean, you've said this, you've posted this many times on your hunting blog, thehuntingbeast.com, but you know, what's your best tool for understanding how wind flows when you're in the swamp, when you're in hill country, when you're hunting field edges, when you're doing anything like that? I mean, what do you use?
Milkweed.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So, you know, to go further than that, there's probably a lot of guys that have never used milkweed that are listening to this. So the difference between milkweed and a little squirt bottle of dust or a little string on your thing is you can see the currents. Because when you drop that milkweed, it follows that wind current wherever it's going. It doesn't just go straight. Because when you blow that dust thing, you see the dust go up and go down, and you go, okay, the wind direction is going that way. That doesn't necessarily, that means where the wind current's going. That's where the wind's going, right at you.
Right.
You know, and I was hunting Iowa a couple of years back, and I shot this really big 8-pointer. And that hunt was unique because my friend Andre invited me down on that hunt. And I was hunting all over the place looking for this thing, and a week had gone by, and I hadn't seen him yet. I'd seen a lot of nice bucks, but not the buck I was after. And he comes back from a hunt, and he says, hey, that buck you're after is using this one ridge. I've seen him up there. We got him on the camera up there. I think there's a good shot up there, and it was my last day to hunt. Mm-hmm. And he says, I'll tell you something. He says, them big bucks don't come out in the opening. They're following the ridge, which I already know, you know. But he says, there's one tree set up in there. He says, it's my kill tree for that spot. He says, I think you should try that tree. Because he knows I don't like hunting other people's stands. But with him, I kind of trust him. And okay.
Right.
And he says, you're going to be tempted to hunt a little lower because this stand's, you know, 30 feet up. He says, and there's a good opening about 20, 25 feet up. He says, but every time I hunted that, he says, you drop the milkweed, it goes right down in the hole and the deer wins you. He says, I couldn't beat it because there's a way the current went through those trees. He says, one day, he goes, I kept trying to hunt it because there's big bucks cruising through there.
Right.
He says, but one day, he says, he let that milkweed over by his head and it's going out. And he noticed that when he puts it by his feet, it drops in the hole. He moved that stand 5 feet up. Now you're killing bucks out of it.
So his example was he was dropping milkweed by his feet. Air current was being sucked down into the opening. And then one day he lets it release up by his head. So literally, yeah, a difference of 5 feet.
Right. And he moved that stand up 6 feet or so. That's it. I could see the marks in the tree. It was literally like 6 feet. And now you're in the wind current. It's blowing over the deer.
Right. Right.
And the way that ridge was, you had to set up upwind of those deer because they're cruising the side of that ridge. You can't get on that ridge without blowing everything out of there.
Right.
So you had to come in from the field, go straight up a tree, and you got a little opening there. But you had to be at a height where it blew over. And you wouldn't know that with dust. You wouldn't know that with a string. But that milkweed told the story.
Right, because you'll know which direction that current is actually going to take your scent past 5 yards.
Right.
You know, which is key. And that's another good point about understanding the setup that you're going to. Because a lot of guys will say, well, then I'll just get 30 feet up everywhere I go. Well, let's, you know, that's not always a realistic option when you're hunting public areas, when you're hunting swamp, there isn't a whole lot of times where you can get 30 feet up in the air.
Yeah, that's a whole nother blog on tree stand height, because there's some critical things on tree stand height. Correct. I mean, number one, I do not want to hunt 30 feet. You got a bad angle, you're going to get one long. You know, you got a lot of issues. But I'll take 30 feet over the deer smelling me.
Right.
You know, and that was the case in this case. And I would have been hunting 6 feet lower, thinking, hoping, or praying that my wind's blowing over him.
Right. If the wind.
If he had not figured that out, moved that stand up, or I'd have set up there and dropped milkweed and go, oh, this stand's wrong. You know, unless I happen to drop it at my head like he did.
So can you talk about an example, because you hunt a lot of swamps, and you talk a lot about finding those points on swamps, on islands. How does the wind affect those points? They're coming off of swamp transitions. You know, what have you observed with how it reacts or acts coming off like an open cattail swamp, and then you're hunting just back inside, you know, those points?
If you remember that setup on the point in the swamp we hunted, mm-hmm. where I went past where you shot your 7-pointer.
Right.
Yeah, there's 2 points that came together, and there's a little open, a little creek ran through there. Did you notice that I got right out into that opening? Because it took my wind right over the top of the cattails.
Right.
You know, so I'm thinking about it that way. But now if he's bedding on that point, now if you got a point where the deer's bedding on it, you got to be back and you got to think about which side the wind's hitting on. You don't want to be right up against where the wind's hitting the side of those trees on the edge of the point. You know, because the swamps you're talking about, a lot of times they have a block of timber where the trees are high.
Right.
The swamp is down low. It's dogwood or a different kind of tree growth or something. And it's hitting a wall. So you're going to get all that swirling. So if possible, you got to be in the timber if you're on the side where the wind's hitting those trees. Be in the timber enough that you're not getting pulled into those vacuums and stuff. Right. You know, if you have to shoot to that side. But the best case scenario is to be in there when you're on the downwind side. You know, but even then you get that vacuum over the top. So being into the timber a little bit is a little bit more controllable.
Because you don't get your scent blowing back out into the swamp, even with the wind in your face, if you're back enough.
Right, but sometimes you can't control that because of where the deer is going and when he's bedding there on what wind. And in that case, you got to have a setup where you know he's going to wind you over here. You have to be able to shoot him over there. You got to shoot him before he gets to your wind. And part of that, you know, you're even going to fool me. I'm going to go out there and set up incorrectly on them winds sometimes. But I'm going to have that milkweed along. I'm going to see it. And there's cases where I'll set up a stand, pull it back down and move. The wind ain't playing right here. It ain't playing the game the way I want to play it.
Right.
And I'm moving. So I'll move my stand over, even if it's 5 feet, 10 feet, whatever I got to do so that I can beat that current or shoot that deer before he gets to it. You know, I've literally had spots where you drop a milkweed and you watch that thing go through the woods and it always ends up in the same spot because it starts following the terrain of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And if the wind's, you know, even if it's off 10 degrees from the day before, it goes to the same spot because it follows the terrain of the trees. And you can watch and drop that milkweed and where it hits, you watch that deer come through the woods when it's not a shooter, and it hits that spot where that milkweed's dropping, and he just stops cold. Sniffs for a second. You know, some of them hardly react. But most of them, you know, stop and look for a second, or put their nose in the air, lick their lip, and then move on. And you can see right where you dropped that milkweed, right where it was hitting, them deer are reacting. So having that in your possession and dropping that stuff and watching that wind current and watching where it goes, and knowing ahead of time when that deer steps out, that's where he's going to win me. I got to shoot that buck before it gets to that spot.
Well, and that kind of is an interesting statement because I hear a lot of guys say sometimes, hey, I'm in my setup. I've got this nice mature deer coming in. He always makes it to this one spot and he freezes on me. I tried coming in different times during the day and he freezes. It might be speaking to the fact that some of those currents are at play there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
and that's the thing, like with these air currents and stuff, when you start talking thermals in woods, the air currents, sometimes when it's calm, you can't feel it one of those little squirt bottles of dust can't see it. Your yarn can't see it, but you drop milkweed and it's going the opposite direction of the wind until the wind blows.
Right.
And then he's like, oh, the deer has a sixth sense.
Not really. I mean, you and I both observed dropping milkweeds where we've had them cast away from us and then rotate around.
Yep.
And come right back in. So back on the topic a little bit of thermals. And how that affects. I mean, sometimes I've hunted spots in swamp where I've had a large pond or significant body of water next to the island that I'm hunting. Or there's been a lot of topics on the forum setting up next to a river's edge in hill country. And guys ask about, well, how can I play the thermal of that body of water either in the morning or in the evening? And if you want to talk about that or discuss that a little bit.
Okay. Well, if we're going to talk about water thermals, basically, there's two things you need to know. I mean, it's the same thing with regular thermals. You know, heat rises, cold drops. So the cold air expands and the warm air rises, right? So if the water's cold, colder than the air, then it's going to hold steady and it's going to push your scent away. If the water's warm, warmer than the air, it's going to pull your scent in. So you could take like a trout stream or something where it's bubbling out of the ground and it's always ice cold.
Right.
That's always going to push your scent. But swamps, that water heats up. Shallow lakes, that water heats up. You know, ponds, water heats up during the day. Mm-hmm. So in the morning, that water is usually cold, stays cold for a while. It's pushing your scent away. So if you set up on the water's edge, it's pushing your scent towards the deer. You might have the wind in your face, but it calms down, your scent's pushing out, right? But in the evening, that water's heated up all day, the sun's shining through to the mud on the bottom, the water's getting warm. Now, that water's warm, the sun goes down, shadow hits the trees and stuff, starts to cool. Well, that water stays warm, it's like bathtub water.
Right.
It stays warm longer than the ground does. So the heat's rising off that pond. So now it's sucking your scent down. So now when you set up, you got to figure that, okay.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
When the sun comes in, or when the sun goes over the hill, this is going to cool down, and that's going to start pulling my scent. So you set up near the edge of the swamp, you know, where there's water in the swamp.
Right.
Near the edge of a pond. So it'll pull your scent in that calm period just before dark away from those deer. So you see now where we hunted, we're hunting points, and we're going up the side of the point and getting set up right along the edge when the deer is going to go down the middle because we know that that scent's going to get pulled out over the swamp.
Right.
And it does, right?
Yeah.
So it's predictable. People just got to understand it and be able to predict it.
So how you describe that is if I'm set up, well, again, depending on what side of that point I'm set up on, I've got to factor in where I figure my predicted deer traffic is going to be to play my scent being pulled away in the opposite direction of where that deer is coming from. And that can differ from what the predominant wind is when I first get in there.
Oh, correct. Absolutely.
Okay.
And you got to figure that most evenings, the wind dies just before dark.
Right.
Right about when those deer come out. And that's when those thermals really take effect. And I'm going to say to the point of 90% of the time, the thermals are going to trump the wind. So you can set up with the wind blowing towards where those deer are going to be. If you're going to have a calm evening, that wind's going to pull right back down come evening. And that's where everybody's like, oh, my wind shift, I'm busted. Right before dark, the wind turned directions. Well, it did it for a reason.
Right. That's interesting.
So then getting back to thermals, mm-hmm. you know, and looking at hills, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand the vacuum effect too. You know, when you get into hill country thermals, when the air starts rising, when the wind's blowing over that hill, it's causing a vacuum and pulling the thermal up the hill. So it's not going straight up, it's going up the hill carrying your scent up.
Right.
Okay. So there's some variations there too, where like if you have good tree cover and you have dark soil, like a field that's been plowed, that plowed field is going to have a lot of thermals because the dark ground is going to
heat up.
Yeah.
Right.
So one thing I would say about thermals in the hills too is you can beat them. You know, a lot of guys have a problem with a deer on a point in hill country that drops down to feet. And you can't get underneath them because you get busted by the thermals rising during the day, right?
Right, because if you set up below, as the edge of that, as it heats up during the day, it's going to, the edge of that hill is going to heat up and it's actually going to pull your scent up the hill towards the point where he's potentially bedding.
Right, and the problem is if you get far enough back, you're not going to see him in daylight. Then he's going to come through and smell that you're there and come through even later the next day.
So in a scenario like that, well, a buck, if he's sitting off a point, he's probably going to be bedding, well, potentially with the wind to his back,
yep,
on the leeward side of the hill, so he gets that swirl.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes it really challenging to try to access them from below.
Correct. So now when you come in from below and he's looking downhill, wind's actually to his back, but he's still got his thermals, and he's sitting right where that thermal and that wind meet, right in the thermal tunnel. And he's looking downhill. He can smell behind him, he can smell below him. But that all changes when the sun goes over the hill. Once that hillside is shaded and starts to cool, all of a sudden the thermals will start to shift and turn around and start going downhill. But there's only a short time period. Depending on how the sun hits that hill, it might be a half an hour, it might be an hour. But you got a short time period to get in there and get set up. In that case, you got to either use a, you know, hunt from the ground or have a tree stand pre-set up, you know, that you'll leave there for when this happens, you know, if it's your private ground. Or be really good at setting that stand up fast. But you need to move in there, get set up quietly and fast. And then when you know, a lot of guys will look at me funny and say, you mean you're hunting 20 minutes of the day? Well, that's when the deer come in anyway.
Right.
You know, you look at half of the deer I killed in the last hour.
Well, and that makes a good point is if you've got, you could potentially in that situation set up 300 yards back, 400 yards back at, let's say, 2 o'clock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Monitor the wind direction, monitor what's going on, and then in that 45-minute window, make your move within 100 yards of where you need to be.
Right, and when I hunt in that manner, that's basically what I do. I'm either sitting in a tree stand a ways away, which I usually don't because it's kind of useless to hunt midday outside of the rut.
Right.
But I do get close and just sit down and wait, you know, with the bow or whatever, and I'm waiting for that period to change because you don't have a lot of time. You don't want to go in there, you know, leave your car or your house at the change. You want to be close enough that it's a short move to get to where you got to be when that wind changes, but not close enough that he's smelling you with those thermals before it changes.
And it's probably an important point to make that during that time of change, you're probably going to have some deer movement otherwise other than just this mature animal. I mean, what you're talking about is specifically potentially targeting a mature animal that you know is bedding there. Because you see it all the time where there's deer movement of doe or fawn or maybe even younger bucks at earlier times during the day. So you've also got to be careful of how you're transitioning to that spot to try to beat those thermals.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of the places I hunt, because I'm hunting a lot of public, have low densities. But when you get onto that private land and stuff, a lot of times you're kicking deer moving into that stuff because they get up, feed, move around or whatever in the higher densities.
Right.
That's tough. You sometimes, like you said, you sit back a little ways, maybe for a day, glass it, see how he comes out and stuff, see where he's vulnerable, you know, from a distance.
Right.
And see what the other deer do and think about, you know, okay, how do I get around the satellite deer? You know. If all else fails and you can't get around them, I say you just walk in and spook them. You know, they run out of there. Everybody thinks that's such a bad thing, but I've you know, walked into bedding areas, had a doe jump up or a satellite buck that's bedded outside of the buck's, you know, the target buck's bedding area,
right,
run right through there. And you'd think that you're done. You climb up the tree, and half an hour later, the thing gets up right where the doe ran through, and shakes off, and comes walking right in. You know, I've also seen it where they get up and run. So right. It's not a good thing, but I'm saying it might just work. And you can't kill the buck if you don't hunt him. If that's the way he's coming down, and you don't give it a shot because you don't want to spook him, what, are you going to just let him live there forever,
right,
unhunted? Yeah. You got to make a move at some point. And when you bust that move, if it don't work, figure out where he moved and hunt him there.
Right.
But you, if you're not hunting him, you're not killing him.
Well, and I think with people listening, there's a couple key points that you made. One, you hinted on observing from a stand, checking wind directions, using milkweed, and using actual observation of the deer movement in relationship to the wind. And once you've sort of figured out a pattern, then move in. And then base it on, you know, the science that you know about what the thermals are doing. So, and then also just the fact of taking a risk. I mean, if you don't get out there and actually try and put some of these things to practice and fail, you're not going to learn what you need to learn to be successful.
Right. Absolutely. You got to experience a deer jumping up and running off that you want to kill to understand how close is too close.
Right.
You have to have been there. You know, you have to spook a few deers to be in the ballgame.
Maybe you want to talk a little bit about, and this kind of highlights on some of what you've done before, but what you talked about earlier, the swamp islands that you hunt, typically a lot of these are very narrow, and there can be predominant winds on certain properties. How can you account for that? For example, let's take the island where I shot that 7-pointer on, okay? That's a very narrow island, and it's flanked on one side by swamp where we figured was the doe bedding area. On the other side, it's flanked, on the east side, it's flanked by a significant pond. And the predominant wind direction that flows through there is a southwest wind for the most part. So if you think about that, when you set up on that island, the doe bedding is off to, it would be my northwest, and that pond is off to my northeast. How do you utilize that, or how would you utilize it to set up?
Well, there's a couple ways you could utilize it. You could pin yourself against the pond and have it pull in your scent, or you could wait for a little odd wind where it's coming from the northwest, because that ain't too uncommon. Mm-hmm. You know, but getting into the center of that isn't bad. And I think about where you set up, it was about perfect. Because you got into the center of that woods where you weren't getting a pull from the sides in either direction. You know, you had a crosswind where they're going to wind you when they come by, but you have an opportunity to kill them before they do.
Right.
You know, so when I think about that, you had about the best. Because you're going to, in the middle of that, you're going to have a pretty steady wind. It's the edges where all that swirling's occurring.
Right.
If that makes sense.
And that spot was interesting based on what you talked about earlier, because it had a little bit of an opening, a small opening. But there was a predominant wind flowing down the center of that island. And early on in that sit, I had a small doe and a small four-pointer come through, but the mature buck didn't come out until right at dark. And actually, the way that wind was traveling, you know, he came off my, what would have been my north side, you know, northwest side from the bedding, hit the trail to travel south on the island, and he didn't come into my scent stream until, well, it was too late, basically. But I was able to, you know, early on in that hunt, I was able to drop milkweeds. He came into the trail that was 12 yards away. The other deer were walking on the trail that was 25 yards away. But I could actually drop milkweed during the early hours of that hunt and see how my scent was traveling at an angle across those two deer paths. And I knew, you know, I had a short window. It was really only about a 10-yard window on both trails, and 10 yards, I mean 10 yards traveling from north to south, where I was going to be able to get a shot before something would smell me.
Yeah, once again, what was key? The milkweed. Because you're able to see exactly where they're going to scent you when they come through.
Right.
Instead of guessing.
And those deer reacted. The two, the doe and the four-pointer, once they hit my set stream, tails raised, and they got a little excited. Not that they knew I was there, but there was a significant difference from when they were coming off my northwest shoulder, walking around. Once they got in front of me, so almost they were straight east of me, they got a little excited. Their tails raised, and they trotted off.
Sometimes when those small islands, too, you can get up high enough. You can pick out a tree that's like an overly large tree for the little island and get up high enough to get in that scent stream over the top.
Now, let's talk a little bit about wind and the use, how bucks use wind to potentially monitor doe bedding spots during the rut, because you've pointed out, you know, we'll talk about islands in the swamp first, and then we can get into a little bit about ridges and hill country, but you've pointed out these areas to me before, and one in particular when we're doing some spring scouting, about how the relationship of a buck bed to where a satellite island is, where we found a lot of doe bedding,
mm-hmm.
and again, the predominant wind. So, you know, speak to that a little about how they monitor that.
Okay, and in that case, we're doing what I like to do, and that's every time you have a failure, when the season's over, you go out there, or not just a failure, but let's say you see a deer, a target buck.
Right.
Whether you shoot it or not, you backtrack it. Let's find out where he came from, what he was doing, why was he here, right? And you had an opportunity at a big buck. So what we did was we backtracked that buck right to his bed, and what we found is that was a rut bed. And that bed was put in his position specifically to observe does leaving a doe bedding area that we knew about,
right?
And if you think back, when you saw that buck, what was he doing? A doe came in from that doe bedding area,
right.
And he popped up out of nowhere, and all of a sudden he's on that doe that was alone when she came on the island,
mm-hmm.
right? And what happened? Another buck popped up from another spot, came in, followed her, right?
Right.
Those are rut beds. They're watching those does in that doe bedding area. And they weren't necessarily downwind of the does, but in a position where they'd hear and see those does get up and leave that doe bedding area.
Right.
Right? So then we, you know, from that, we knew exactly where that, you know, buck was bedded there and where future bucks will bed there from now on. Because that's the thing people don't get either, is they think that bedding's random. It's not.
Well,
that'll repeat year after year. And anybody that wants to argue with me hasn't hunted the way I have and hasn't looked at beds the way I have. Because I've gone out and found this stuff, and year after year after year, see them bucks in that same spot.
Right. Well, and the other thing, if you look at the position in that specific case, if you look at the position where that massive scrape was in the rub, again, right at the apex of that island, where from a vantage point that buck could hear and see and smell, and that doe, she walked right up to the top where that scrape was and sat there. She was a hot doe, so you know her scent was traveling off that island. And not a minute later, that mature buck got up to give chase to see what was going on. The other one I wanted you to touch on is that other buck bed that we found that was just off of the island next to the pond. The parking lot buck. The one we kept seeing night. And that had a lot of doe bedding on that island that was adjacent to where that buck bed was. And the wind is fairly standard in how it blows over that one island. So, you know, what did you think about how he was using that in the rut?
It looked to me like the where the does were bedding and traveling. I mean, there's they're bedding along a strip of trees in a swamp adjacent to a pond where people just didn't go because it was all wet and nasty back there.
Right.
And the predominant downwind side was into some cattails that had a finger of dogwood, like a point, coming out of it.
Right.
And what happened was, when we were going back there to access it, we come out in the evening, you know, right at closing time, several times there's a good buck there that runs off. And there's all the trees are rubbed. And you could look at that, and what did I say? I said he's going to be bedding right in that point.
Right.
And we walked in there, and what did we find?
Yeah.
Right in that point. He had his nose working to smell anything that went down that finger where all the does hang. And he had everything marked up to say to anybody else that came through there buckwise that, hey, this is my area, you know. And he was really monitoring that, and even pre-rut quite a bit. I think it was early October we were seeing him in there already.
Right, right. And that particular spot is pretty interesting. Like you said, that pond is actually, it blocks certain access points of those deer traveling, you know, east and west on that property. They actually have to move north and south across the little island they were bedding on to get onto the other peninsula. And the spot where he had his bed, you know, he could pick up, if there's just an off wind that's just off coming, you know, northwest, he could pick up anything that travels across that island.
Right.
Where it was sitting.
Right. And it's, you know, when you think about that now, both those beds that we just discussed are both rut beds. Right?
Right.
One's using vision, one's using his nose.
Yeah.
So they don't always bed the same. You know, and one of the spots where I've killed a lot of bucks, that one I killed early season, that spot is a primary bedding area that has bucks bedding there all the time. But every time, just before rut, the biggest buck in the area will be bedded there because there's a doe bedding area just up, and they're actually monitoring a funnel that comes out of the doe bedding area. Where to stay in timber, the does go through this little funnel of trees.
Right.
And are actually monitoring that instead of the doe bedding area.
So let's talk a little bit about wind and setting up in hill country locations and how you've talked about this on the site quite a bit, but setting up in that wind tunnel or what, explain to the people who haven't heard it before what that actually is and what you're trying to do.
Well, the wind tunnel is where the wind's blowing over the ridge, so you're on the leeward side, okay? And you got a thermal down below that the wind's blowing over. So the valley being heated up, the air's rising, and you got the normal air blowing over the ridge. And there's a vacuum that occurs that pulls that air from the valley up the side of that hill. And it, depending on the size of the hill, it can actually be a pretty strong wind if it's a hot day.
Right.
You know, going the opposite direction of the regular wind. And where that thermal air current meets that wind on the hillside, where they collide, it starts to roll, and there's what I call a wind tunnel. And right where that collision takes course of those two air currents meeting is where bucks bed. And it's where they cruise during rut. Bucks will use their nose to travel during the rut. They don't normally do that outside of the rut, just to a small degree, despite what the majority of people think. So, anywho, that's like a roadmap. If you take your property and you look at your hills, really, during the rut, all you have to do to worry about is that elevation where that wind tunnel is and then the leeward side of the hills. And what you're going to find is if you take like a marker and mark up those leeward sides, you're going to find a series of paths and you're going to see one that connects everything. And that's where you want to be. You want to connect all these, you know, points and hills that are leeward where deer are bedding with another series. So if you get one ridge that connects a whole bunch of ridges, you know, from a whole bunch of ridges, the bucks are going to cruise through there looking for does, because they're going to go from doe bedding area to doe bedding area during the rut, and they're going to cruise that leeward side. So you're trying to find a funnel that's not really like a funnel, like a narrow point.
Right.
It's going to be a funnel of only one ridge cuts over there that's on the leeward side.
Right.
And when you get up there, I guarantee you eventually bucks are going to start going through there during the rut.
Yeah, and for people that, I guess it's hard, sometimes it's hard for people to conceptualize it because we don't use our nose like that, right?
Right.
We're not sitting, you know, 50 yards up on the side of a ridge that's 15 yards off the peak of a ridge, utilizing our nose to smell stuff coming from the peak and to smell stuff coming from down below.
Well, let's put it in perspective.
I mean, we use our eyes to try to do that. So in our mind, I want to be right at the top of the ridge so I can see over both sides, so I can see
what's
coming.
Right.
But a deer, it's not thinking that way.
We'll put it in perspective. You know, a deer has almost 300 million receptors in its nose, and it's got a bomber nasal organ that our scientists still don't even know exactly what it does. Somehow it breaks down the sense and anywho, we've got 5 million receptors, no vomer nasal organ, right? And the only thing that can smell better than a deer that I know of is a bear, and they can smell slightly better.
Right.
And you watch these radio collar things with bears when they come out of their dens and they're hungry and they start traveling around, and watch them turn and go at a 90-degree angle in a straight beeline right to a food source because they smell it upwind. It's unbelievable. They can smell a piece of food from 10 miles away in the wind current and go straight to it. You know, and deer smell about the same as them. So why would they cruise that thermal tunnel? Because they can smell everything upwind and everything downwind because of the thermals. So if they go near a doe that's in heat, they're going to smell her.
Right.
That's why they bed there, even outside of the rut. I mean, they're always bedding in that thermal tunnel. And then they bed on points, too. Why would they pick a point? Because that thermal comes in from multiple directions up that point and meets at the tip. So now they can smell in a radius around their bed.
Right.
Upwind, downwind, sidewind. So yeah. Now how do you get them?
Well, and I think, yeah, people underestimate the smelling ability of a white-tailed deer. And I think, you know, I mean, compare them to a bloodhound. You know, no one will ever question the nose of a bloodhound.
And yet a deer could smell better.
Right. And yet, you know, again, you can go, you guys listening to the show can go out and do your own research, and you'll find varying topics on, you know, between bloodhounds and deer and whatever. But the fact of the matter is no one questions a bloodhound's nose, yet, you know, a deer's nose is just as significant. Just to summarize in general, I mean, we've pretty much touched on all the high points of wind. I think the big thing is, you know, understand your wind direction when you're going into an area. So check the weather, find out your predominant wind. But when you get into an area, get yourself some milkweed and understand how it's flowing across the topography that you're in.
Being somewhat mobile, too.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to lock yourself to a tree, despite the wind.
Being mobile helps. Understand thermals, whether you're next to a body of water, a swamp, and understand how they have effects on wind currents and how those thermals may affect the wind direction or how your scent is being pulled in the evening or in the morning. And then in hill country can get a little crazy with the wind. Do a couple setups and scouting and try to find that wind tunnel. Again, we're just talking just off of the leeward side of that edge. Get out and try to observe these things, especially in the off season. If you want to discuss this podcast, you can log on to thehuntingbeast.com and we'll have discussion points on there that you can post back. Thank you.
That concludes today's podcast episode. Please go to thehuntingbeast.com to post any discussions, questions, or comments regarding today's podcast episode.